From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, David Lynch, the director of the films Eraserhead and Blue Velvet and the TV series Twin Peaks, talks about his inspiration and his rules of art. He has a new book of photographs which catalog his visual obsessions. Also today, why has Yasser Arafat lost the confidence of so many Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza Strip? We talk with Yusuf Ibrahim, regional Middle East correspondent for the New York Times. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Barbara Campbell. Republican members of Congress say they're happy that President Clinton plans to propose a middle-class tax cut during his nationally broadcast speech tonight. GOP lawmakers maintain the president is following their lead. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
House Republicans called for a tax credit for families with children in the Contract with America. Republican Senator Phil Graham of Texas outlined a similar proposal today. The GOP feels it's already won the public relations battle over who is driving the tax and spending cut bandwagon, incoming House Budget Committee Chairman John Kasich.
And what I'm excited about is the president says he wants to privatize the FAA. That's a Republican proposal. It saves a lot of money. The president's talked about killing departments. That's a Republican proposal. We're thrilled that he's moving in that direction. The president's saying everything's on the table. That's Republican rhetoric and Republican statements.
Republicans, armed with GOP-prepared responses to the president's expected proposal, sounded a unified message today. We welcome the president's support of our idea. This is Brian Naylor at the Capitol.
Former White House Travel Office Director Billy Dale pleaded not guilty today to federal charges that he embezzled travel office funds. Dale's lawyer filed a request with the court for a subpoena that would give him access to a wide range of White House documents linked to the case. Dale has been accused in a 2-count indictment of stealing tens of thousands of dollars in cash and checks. His lawyer has portrayed Dale as a scapegoat in the attempt by members of the Clinton entourage to take over the travel office operation. Former President Jimmy Carter says he's willing to go to Bosnia to try to end the fighting in the former Yugoslav Republic. The Bosnian Serb leader Radovan Karadzic extended the invitation and said he expects Carter to arrive this weekend. Barry Schwein reports.
This would be a tough assignment, tougher perhaps than persuading Haiti's military rulers to step aside and North Korea to freeze its nuclear program. But Jimmy Carter's style of mediating without taking sides may be the only viable strategy to get the Bosnian Serbs to the peace table and to assure relief supplies for the frightened and shell-shocked people of Bosnia. Carter's credentials are obvious. Karadzic's motives are not. He has found the UN and NATO unwilling to stop his drive on Muslim enclaves, and the Clinton administration has shelved the threat to get weapons to the Muslims and to push NATO to attack Serb artillery. But Carter demonstrated in dealing with North Korea's communist leaders and Haiti's military junta, he can work out settlements with all sorts of people. For National Public Radio, this is Barry Schwein at the State Department.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up more than 28 points at 3774.22 in heavy trading of 321 million shares. The Nasdaq Composite Index is up 2 points. This is NPR News. Sweden announced today that it will leave more than 800 bodies inside the sunken ferry Estonia and preserve the wreck in the Baltic Sea as a grave. Some relatives wanted their loved ones' remains for burial and are accusing the government of making the decision based on the cost of retrieving the bodies. The United Nations Children's Fund says there has been significant progress toward reducing malnutrition, preventing disease and illiteracy. In a report, UNICEF also predicts further progress in the future. NPR's Trevor Rowe reports.
In 1990, world leaders gathered at the UN for the World Summit for Children. Among other things, they pledged a major reduction in child and maternal mortality, malnutrition, as well as to eradicate polio and a 90% reduction in measles by the year 2000. Karen Shampoo, the Deputy Executive Director of UNICEF, says international efforts are meeting with success.
Overall, we find that in more than 100 developing countries, with 90% of the developing world's children. They are making a significant progress towards the goals that were set just 4 years ago.
Champu says measles deaths are down by 80%. Many countries are now free of polio, and oral rehydration has prevented more than 1 million child deaths each year. However, she says there is still a need for industrialized countries to provide funding in order to ensure that all goals are met. This is Trevor Rowe in New York.
Shots were fired in Manger Square in Bethlehem today as Israeli police chased Palestinian stone throwers. Police say Palestinian youth threw stones and bottles at an Israeli police station in Manger Square. Police chased them. An officer fired twice in the air. Officers detained several suspects and no one was hurt. Residents of Bethlehem, which is in the occupied West Bank, had been hoping for a quieter Christmas season than during the 7-year Palestinian uprising, now that the PLO and Israel have a peace plan. I'm Barbara Campbell in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is David Lynch. His first film, Eraserhead, was a creepy nightmare about alienation and parenthood that played the midnight movie circuit for years. He went on to direct The Elephant Man, Dune, Blue Velvet, and Wild at Heart. His TV series, Twin Peaks, was perhaps the most offbeat, surrealistic hit in TV history. Now Lynch has a book of photographs called Images, and includes stills from his films, as well as other photographs that catalog his visual obsessions. One chapter, for instance, is called Organic Phenomena. It includes a photo he took in a basement hospital of a cabinet with drawers marked amputated foot, gangrene, kidney, and larynx carcinoma. There's a photograph of a facial sore and another of a decapitated head from his film Eraserhead. I asked him if there were body images or aspects of the body that disturbed him when he was young.
Since we're inside a body, there's a yearning to look at them and know them. And they exist in many shapes and forms, and they have such interesting textures. It's an important place to start this search for the secrets of many things that go together to make up, say, paintings or art.
Would you stare at yourself a lot, stare at your body, also stare in the mirror? And were there things about your own body that you found disturbing?
Well, I wasn't... I wouldn't say I was just hung up on it, but I'm very interested in organic phenomenon, and like I said, it's we find ourselves in these bodies, so they're very interesting, and I think there's a lot to learn, like about proportion and repetition of shapes. Like I say, a painting that works obeys certain rules. And those rules are at work in the way the body is put together as well.
Well, I want to connect this organic phenomena section of your book, Images, to the first movie that was actually theatrically released, Eraserhead, which really is one of the most unappetizing movies ever made, I think. The story is... What's that?
I don't know about that.
The story is about Henry, who gets his girlfriend pregnant, and their baby is this kind of braying creature. And I just want to play the scene where his girlfriend's mother corners Henry to see if he's the father and if he's been having sex with the daughter.
Henry, I asked you if you and Mary had sexual intercourse.
Well, I don't think that's any of your business.
Henry!
Sorry.
You're in very bad trouble if you won't cooperate.
Well, Mary?
Mother! Answer me.
I'm too nervous.
There's a baby. It's at the hospital.
Mom!
And you're the father.
But that's impossible. It's only...
Mother, they're still not sure it is a baby.
It's premature, but there's a baby.
Well, I think you were already a father when you made this movie. Was fatherhood disturbing to you?
Yes, it was.
What was disturbing about it?
Well, I was studying to be a painter and very keen on living the art life. And in the art life, the way I saw it then, you know, it didn't have room for, you know, a family life.
I'm wondering if the idea of a crying infant was almost incomprehensible to you, if you felt so far away from understanding an infant, if it seemed like a creature or an animal to you.
Well, Eraserhead's about, you know, a couple of different things. And one of the things it's about is a family, but it could also be about other things. So I really love abstractions and things that maybe could be interpreted in different ways. So I don't really like to talk about the meaning so much. It's open for interpretation.
It sure is, and everybody interprets it differently. I mean, I've personally heard so many different interpretations of
right.
Of Eraserhead. I can understand you wanting to leave it that way.
Now, I think, you know, when you make a film, inside you, I don't always know what I'm doing, and it's a process, you know, from when you start to when you finish. It's becoming something, and you have to always be questioning yourself and finding if it feels right. And it has, on some level, it has to feel correct and honest to the person making the film. But as soon as it's over and people see it, it's like I say, when it's a little bit abstract, everybody has their own interpretation. That's the way it should be. Now people are making films that are so one thing that most people have the same interpretation, and it's not very exciting to me.
It sounds like you must work pretty intuitively.
That's the whole thing.
Well, this whole sense of the body and what's normal and what's abnormal and what's ugly and what's beautiful, I mean, that's not only part of Eraserhead, but it's also in a very different way in the film Elephant Man, which you directed, which is a beautiful film about, you know, the man who had tumors all over his body
right.
during Victorian England and was saved from a freak show by a doctor who was interested in studying his body.
Mm-hmm.
Was this a subject you were already interested in, and when the movie was proposed to you, did it seem like a perfect fit to you?
Yes, I heard the name The Elephant Man, and a physical pop went off in my brain, and I knew I had to make that film. And luckily, I was able to do it.
No, you know, in the Broadway version, because it was originally a Broadway show, the show prided itself on not showing any of the actual tumors on the Elephant Man. It was all done through kind of posture and suggestion. Your film is the opposite. I mean, it quite graphically shows terrible tumors growing from this person's face.
Mm-hmm.
Was that important to you to actually picture it? I mean, at the beginning of the film, he has a shroud over his head, and then that shroud is lifted.
Mm-hmm. It's very important. The whole idea was that you could have someone that was so horrible on the outside, yet his spirit was so, so beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
And the more you get to know him, the more the outside disappears, the more the spirit and the shines through. And if you don't start from the reality, there's really nowhere to go. And this person was revealed, you know, in many ways throughout the film. And no matter what he looked like, people fell in love with him. And that's the story. There are other people that look fantastic, and once you get to know them, they're what's shining forth from inside is not so pleasing.
Eraserhead was your first theatrical released movie, and it became a midnight movie classic. Did you know anything about how to market a film? Did you know how to represent yourself to the film industry?
No, I knew nothing about. When I started making films, I knew nothing about film. And after Eraserhead was finished, after 5 years of working on it, I didn't know if anything would ever happen to the film. But Ben Barinholtz, who they call the grandfather of midnight films, he got Eraserhead for his company, Libra Films. And he told me, he said, "David, we're not going to spend one nickel on this picture. We're just going to open it in a theater and let it sit there. And this is a word-of-mouth picture." And he said, "If we hold on long enough, you know, one day the theater will be full." And that's exactly what happened. And those were the times when there were many theaters that had midnight shows. And it was beautiful because these were films that in today's world would, you know, come and go. When something's allowed to only, you know, work or fail in 1 week's time. And so you'd see on the marquee Eraserhead year after year, and eventually you'd want to go see it.
What was that point like for you when Eraserhead started to catch on and you started to get offers to do other movies?
I didn't get any offers. I was brought into a couple of meetings at studios, and they were just disastrous. Nobody wanted me to work just from Eraserhead except Mel Brooks for The Elephant Man.
You know, it's always surprising to me that Mel Brooks, who we think of for his comedies, was so interested in having you direct The Elephant Man.
Yeah.
It's almost hard for me to imagine him relating to that pretty avant-garde eeriness and alienation in Eraserhead.
Yeah, I was sweating bullets when Mel was in the screening room looking at Eraserhead. And
he went in just to scout you?
No, Jonathan Sanger, who was a producer, produced The Elephant Man, told me that everybody, the writers were on, he was on, you know, the thing was going, but Mel wanted to see Eraserhead before he would let me direct the picture. And everything, you know, rode or fell on that screening. So I said, "Jonathan, there's no way Mel's going to, you know, like this, go for Eraserhead." And Jonathan said, "Well, let's just wait and see." So it's a true story. After the screening, Mel literally ran out of the theater and embraced me and said, "You're a madman. I love you." So, but Mel is an extremely complex, interesting fellow.
My guest is director David Lynch. He has a new book of photographs called Images. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. David Lynch is my guest. He has a new book of photographs called Images. Now, I want to talk to you about urban landscapes, which is another theme that runs through your new book, Images, and through several of your films.
Right.
In Eraserhead, for instance, there's always something dripping or rumbling in the background. I mean, the whole film is set against this grimy, abandoned urban decay. There seems to be two types of places that interest you most. One is the small, overtly cheerful, all-American town like Lumberton and Blue Velvet or like Twin Peaks. And the other is the decaying, abandoned industrial landscape like in Eraserhead. But even in Blue Velvet, the evil happens in the more urban part of town. You've actually lived in both locations, haven't you?
Right. You know, where you are now, Philadelphia is, I always say that Eraserhead is, you know, my Philadelphia story. And when you, I came from smaller places in the Northwest. You know, I grew up there till I didn't move to the East Coast till I was 15. And when you come from someplace like that and see a place like Philadelphia or, you know, Brooklyn, New York, it has an impact, and it completely fascinated me. And I used to go around in Philadelphia and feel this strangeness, and it was so powerful and fantastic. It really did something to me.
Your interest in industrial settings, you know, urban decay. I mean, it's so apparent in a couple of your movies, Eraserhead, but also in Elephant Man. Elephant Man is set in the early days of industrialization in England, when there's just like soot and grime all over the city.
Right.
And could you talk a little bit about what kind of effect you wanted the city to have in Elephant Man? What kind of visceral effect you wanted it to have on the viewers?
Well, it was... because it was the Industrial Revolution going on at that time, and because the Elephant Man, you know, looked the way he looked, he was almost like a product of that. And since I'm fascinated with smoke and fire and industry and all the things that happen in factories, it was just an opportunity, you know, at every point I could in the film to, you know, put something like that in. And that Mount St. Helena's eruption, when you see close-ups of the eruption, the smoke, the curls of the smoke, or like the curls of the smoke in an atomic bomb, look very much like the growths on the Elephant Man's body. There's some connection of the way a growth grows. It's just a slow motion version of an explosion, sort of. And I was, you know, these textures and the sounds and all these things seemed right for that world that the Elephant Man came from.
Because of those connections that you wanted to get between industry and tumors, did you work closely with the makeup person to create the effect that you were looking for physically in the Elephant Man?
Well, that's a long story, but I was supposed to, you know, do the makeup myself, and I failed very miserably, and it was about the worst time in my life. And Christopher Tucker took over the job and did a beautiful thing. I had made friends with a man named Dr. Nunn, who ran the a little, you know, museum in the back of the London Hospital. And the death cast from the Elephant Man exists there. And after the Elephant Man died, they cast his body then made a plaster replica of his head and shoulders, and one arm and one foot. And Dr. Nunn let the head and shoulders out of the museum and gave it to Christopher Tucker to model the makeup after.
Wow. That's
yeah.
Amazing. No, I have to ask you a couple of questions about Blue Velvet.
Okay.
Was there something in particular that inspired the story?
Not really. The first two or three ideas were a neighborhood, kind of a green lawns with shadows, like lit at night from a light bulb, and red lips, and the color blue. And the song Blue Velvet, Bobby Vinton's version, influenced it a lot.
I've always wondered how you managed to take a Bobby Vinton record and turn it into a song about sexual fetishism.
Well, it's all in the lyrics there.
You think? Yeah, oh, I guess. Yeah. Yeah. Did you hear it that way when you were young?
No. You know, sometimes the timing has to be correct. You hear something for years and nothing happens, and then one day you hear it connected with some other thought that may be happening, and something magical happens.
I just have one other body kind of question for you.
Okay.
And this is about the ear in Blue Velvet. In your film Blue Velvet, the plot is set in motion when Kyle MacLachlan discovers a decapitated ear in the grass. What makes this especially disturbing is not only the ants crawling through the ear, but also that some of the hair is still attached to the ear. Could you talk at all about how that image came to you?
Well, I don't know exactly how it came, but it, Jeffrey, the ear is like a canal. It's like an opening, a little egress into another place. And it seemed like a perfect, it's like a ticket to another world that he finds. And, I mean, if he hadn't found it, you know, he would have kept on going home, and that would have been the end of it. But the fascination with this, once found, drew him into something that he needed to discover and work through.
What have you been doing since Twin Peaks?
I've been, you know, trying to find my next project, painting. And that's about it.
When you say trying to find your next project, does that require you trying to figure out what you want to do, or do you mean trying to find somebody to finance what you know?
No, I have financing, but I just haven't fallen in love with something yet, and I'm struggling to, you know, to find it. I've written with my friend Bob Engels a comedy that could be my next picture.
Is it unnerving for you to be in a period where you don't know what you want to do next and you're not falling in love with an idea?
Yeah, it's unnerving, but it happens to me all the time. I just don't seem to be able to do one thing after another, like a string of things like some people are, you know, able to do. I can never seem to. There's always a period in between that I'm struggling to figure out what to do.
So how do you cast about for your next project? Do you sit and think a lot, or wait for it to happen?
Yeah, I sit and think a lot, and I read books, and if I find something I like, I have to wait a month or so to make sure it's something I like, and now I'm discovering that I wait 2 weeks and the thing falls away. So in order to work for a year or a year and a half, you really have to be deeply in love with something, and it's difficult to find.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us about your work.
Well, thank you for talking to me.
David Lynch has a new book of photographs called Images. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. PLO leader Yasser Arafat once represented hope and unity to the Palestinians of the Gaza Strip and West Bank. Now he's the symbol of things gone wrong. Coming up, we talk with New York Times Middle East correspondent Youssef Ibrahim about the increasing Palestinian opposition to Arafat. That's coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Barbara Campbell. President Clinton will spell out his goals for the next 2 years during a 10-minute broadcast speech planned for tonight. Analysts view the speech as an attempt to revive the president's image as a political force, with Republicans poised to assume control of Congress next month. Administration officials say Mr. Clinton will recommend $50 billion in income tax reductions to be offset by cutting federal spending. France has rejected the new peace initiative by the Bosnian Serbs, calling it provocative. Lynn Terry reports from Paris.
Foreign Minister Alain Juppé said the proposal by Bosnian Serb leader Radovan Karadzic is unacceptable. Karadzic proposed that his forces give up some territory, release UN prisoners, and allow UN convoys to travel unhindered. Juppé said any settlement must be based on the contact group's peace plan. He said very few parts of that plan could be changed. Juppé said all the contact group can do now is to try to spur new negotiations, which he acknowledged is not succeeding. The foreign minister repeated that the UN peacekeeping forces cannot continue to remain in their current situation. He said if the troops stay in Bosnia, they must be allowed to work and not remain at the mercy of the Serbs. For National Public Radio, I'm Lynn Terry in Paris.
Russian troops shelled rebel fighters north of Chechnya's capital today. The Russians are trying to encircle the city of Grozny to pressure the separatists to give up. Chechnya declared itself independent of Moscow 3 years ago, but Russia just sent troops in this week. Russian President Boris Yeltsin announced yesterday that Chechen rebels now have until Saturday to lay down their arms. Earlier, he had set today as the deadline. A new poll released by the National Women's Political Caucus finds that women are less than half as likely as men to consider running for office, despite the fact that election results show they are just as likely to win. NPR's Caroline Clark-Kelly reports.
Pollster Celinda Lake surveyed likely voters, along with male and female executives, attorneys, and political activists. She found that men and women shared many of the same reasons for not running: concern about family, public scrutiny, and money. But in addition, she found that women were much more likely than men to feel they couldn't win.
Women are more likely to say that they feel less qualified, that they perceive themselves to know less about how to run for office. Probably the most important thing that we found in this study is the role that training and mentors can play to substitute for the difference feedback that men and women are getting in their actual world.
The National Women's Political Caucus says in response to the poll, it will step up its own recruitment and training efforts and work on convincing fundraisers, unions, and state parties to back female candidates. I'm Carol Ann Clark-Kelly in Washington.
Stock prices closed higher again today. The Dow gained 19 points. The Nasdaq Composite Index rose 2 points. This is NPR News. The first layoffs have been announced in the wake of the investment crisis in California's Orange County. The Saddleback Valley Unified School District has given 47 employees 1 day's notice that they will be furloughed. A district spokeswoman says the workers being laid off include custodians, clerks, and classroom aides. Orange County declared bankruptcy last week after suffering losses in its investment pool estimated at $2 billion. Law enforcement officials in Kansas City are investigating 2 failed firebombings at abortion clinics. Mary Jo Draper of member station KCUR in Kansas City reports.
Around midnight, someone hurled an incendiary device onto the roof of a Kansas City, Kansas clinic. The device didn't start a fire as it was apparently meant to. This morning, Planned Parenthood workers in Kansas City, Missouri found containers of flammable liquid with fuses made of rags on their doorstep. FBI spokesman Jeff Lanza says the damage could have been severe.
It had gone off as designed. It probably would have caused an explosion and a great deal of damage due to the explosion, as well as a fire from the explosion and the liquid.
Lanza says although federal investigators haven't pinpointed a connection, it seems logical that the two similar incidents in a 12-hour period might be related. For National Public Radio, I'm Mary Jo Draper in Kansas City.
A UN report on the state of the world's children says a global offensive against polio, measles, and diarrhea is working. UNICEF says vaccinations and other drugs are helping millions of children escape several diseases that kill and maim, but it says pneumonia and malnutrition are still rampant killers. A UNICEF spokesman says extraordinary progress has been made for children since 1990, when a world summit launched a campaign. A spokesman says if policymakers put children at the center of their priorities, the entire human condition would improve. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Yasser Arafat may have just picked up his Nobel Peace Prize, but to many Palestinians, he's no longer a hero. As the leader of the new Palestinian Authority in the West Bank and Gaza, he's being met with increasing opposition. In a recent New York Times article, my guest Yusuf Ibrahim reported that graffiti slogans now denounce Arafat's armed militias and police force as killers of Palestinians, Israel's loyal servants, and the dogs of Arafat. Yusuf Ibrahim is the Times' regional Middle East correspondent. He grew up in Cairo and was educated there and in the United States. He's currently in New York, where we spoke with him earlier today. Yusuf Ibrahim told me there's a widening segment of Palestinians who feel cut off from the peace process.
There are two segments of Palestinians involved in this peace process. There are the Palestinians outside who are the refugees who have been in the diaspora, so to speak. And these were cut out in the first place because the peace process did not involve them, or it said it was going to involve them at a later stage. So the target of this peace process were the Palestinians who were in the West Bank and in Gaza. And in June, of course, many of these Palestinians were rather euphoric about the prospect of an end to Israeli occupation and a move towards autonomy. And these are the Palestinians we are talking about. These are the Palestinians who today feel the peace process is kind of bypassing them, that it is not achieving any of the goals that they were hoping for in June. And I went back just last month, and I was stunned by how much disillusion there is now in the West Bank and in Gaza.
Would you say that Hamas is becoming more popular than the PLO in the territories?
Yes, but we have to qualify this. Hamas is two things. Hamas is first an Islamic movement, and has always existed as a philosophy, ideology, a movement that advocates a sort of strict Islamic, purist Islamic, if you like, situation and beliefs. But Hamas is also at this moment acquiring another dimension, which is that it is becoming the only Palestinian organization strong enough, real enough, present enough, that is opposed to Israeli occupation, because the PLO, which was the other organization, the other Palestinian organization that represented resistance to Israeli occupation, has made peace with Israel.
There have been a lot of battles between the Palestinian Authority police and street protesters in the territories. What have those fights been about?
Essentially, they have been about power and also about the behavior of the Palestinian Authority, which is headed by Yasser Arafat. Mr. Arafat has behaved increasingly since he has arrived to the territory as, another sort of third world dictator, if you like. He has come in and proceeded to ignore the kind of broad aspirations that motivated the enthusiasm for the peace process in Gaza and in the occupied territories. But most importantly, he has largely excluded the people of Gaza and the people of the West Bank from the power and the ruling process. He has brought in with him a large collection of exiles, people like him who were living outside the occupied territories for the last 40 years or so, and empowered those people. And then the other thing he did is he took away or attempted to take away any power or influence from those who have been inside in the last 27 years, essentially mounting, organizing, or suffering from the Israeli occupation of Gaza and the West Bank. So by doing this, he has really provoked the fight. The fight has moved in several stages. It started as criticism, surprise, a sense of being offended, and then it moved to another stage. But at every stage, I think the initiative was always taken by Yasser Arafat, not really by Hamas. And when I say the initiative, I mean the initiative of taking power away, of marginalizing people who, until, say, June, when he arrived, basically ran Gaza and the West Bank and managed the resistance to Israeli occupation.
Are the laws that the Palestinian police are enforcing in the West Bank and Gaza considered unjust by some of the people protesting against them?
You know, the problem is that there are no laws. The laws are, there is literally no law which governs anywhere in the West Bank or Gaza, or which applies anywhere in the West Bank and Gaza. There is a mishmash of laws inherited from the Ottoman Empire, British occupation of the region, which were eventually adopted by the Israelis and which technically should no longer apply. And since the autonomy process came into life, and the PLO has really not initiated any new laws. So what is happening is that the law is becoming basically what Arafat says it is. And it is a very capricious process. It is a very chaotic process. And there is virtually no way, you know, there is no legal path to follow if, say, you're robbed and you want to complain, you want to go to the police station. There's simply no due process of any kind. And that may sound terrible to people who have lived in a society that had always law and order. It is not that much of a surprise in the occupied territories because the law essentially was what the Israelis imposed, and now the law is becoming what Arafat has imposed. But even under the Israelis, there was a certain measure of due process, very limited one, and of course applied very capriciously, but it was there. Right now, there simply isn't.
My guest is Youssef Ibrahim, regional Middle East correspondent for the New York Times. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Youssef Ibrahim. He covers the Arab world for the New York Times. You write that in some of the prisons in Gaza and the West Bank, Islamic militants who are imprisoned are taunting their Palestinian guards by addressing them in Hebrew, the language that the militants learned in Israeli prisons. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if you've had a chance to talk with, say, Palestinian guards in prisons about any crisis that they might be going through, having to be seen as the enemy by fellow Palestinians.
I did, and it is traumatic. You have to appreciate that while many of these people work for the Palestinian Authority, they are Palestinian too. And they have come back to Gaza, say, after years and years in exile. Some of them are young enough, that they've never seen Gaza. This is their first time around. Now, you're talking about people who have been watching quote unquote occupied Palestine from the outside for years, who've been dreaming about it, have been building all these visions of life in an independent Palestinian state, who came in June or July in the summer and were greeted effusively, were showered with food and candy, were kissed, were carried around, were the object of adulation, practically speaking, by the people of Gaza, who suddenly now are finding themselves, accused of being henchmen, torturers, policemen. Whether they do it or not is beside the point. They are conducting interrogation sessions of Palestinians who were in that same jail, who might have been in that same jail, say 6 months, 2 years, 5 years ago, being interrogated by an Israeli Shin Bet or officer or secret police officer, who might have been beaten by the Israelis, who now may be slapped by a Palestinian. Some of these who do the violence or who do the interrogation are hardliners committed to what they do. Most of the Palestinian police is traumatized, and that is where Hamas says Arafat cannot count on his police because the process wears them down. It's very shocking. It is traumatic. And many of them really will not be able to support playing the role of oppressor of their own Palestinian brethren.
Are there other similar crises happening behind the scenes at the Palestinian Authority?
I think definitely, and it's very simple to see, increasingly the Palestinian Authority, the hardest little core of the Palestinian Authority, is becoming a little island isolated by itself. A lot of the well-known Palestinian intellectuals, the names that everybody has heard over the past few years, people like Hanan Ashrawi, Sarino Seba, Dr. Hedar Abdeshefi, are simply withdrawing. I mean, they are moving away. They are cutting themselves off from Arafat.
But does that mean they're functionally removing themselves from a leadership position temporarily?
Yes.
For two reasons. Some, for strategic reasons. Some think, calculate that this whole first rank of Palestinian leadership that came in is burning itself out and that it will be discredited. And then there will be a time for the bright ones to come back in and take charge. And some others are thoroughly disgusted and they don't want to have anything to do with a process which they believe wasn't meant to succeed in the first place.
Well, Hamas says it's the only alternative to Arafat. Are there other alternatives?
No, it is not evident that there are any other alternatives for a number of reasons. I mean, we have to think of the Palestinians as a deeply traumatized population, a population whose social structures, political structures have been essentially dismantled or so severely shaken up that there is no process through which reasonable opposition or positions can materialize, be channeled, and eventually emerge. But more importantly, on the intellectual level, the alternatives are also very non-existent because the old left, which was the mainstay of opposition, of the Palestinian opposition movement, is discredited. I mean, nobody believes in leftist causes anymore. The socialist and the Marxist Palestinian organization, which were many, simply no longer have an ideological backbone. They have collapsed, like the Popular Front for the Democratic Front for the Liberation of Palestine, the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine. They have their fighters, they have their exiles, they have their leaders, they are out there in Syria, in Lebanon, wherever, but they have no audience. Hamas, on the other hand, when you strip it of its Palestinian resistance platform, is a very narrow in many ways, very reactionary Muslim fundamentalist movement. It really doesn't look at the future, it looks at the past. What it says to the Palestinians is if we go back to the strictest fundamentalist interpretation of Islam, things are going to be all right, but it doesn't say how they're going to be all right. It only says we got to throw, we got to liberate all of Palestine. It's a program that most Palestinians have abandoned. I mean, they've been trying to liberate all of Palestine for 45 years. They have lost each war, and they have lost that war. And they have come around to accepting that they might get to make a deal with Israel.
My guest is Yusuf Ibrahim, regional Middle East correspondent for The New York Times. We'll be back in a minute. This is Fresh Air. The president will be addressing the nation later tonight. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, will you be looking ahead to the president's talk?
We will. We'll hear from Elizabeth Arnold about some of the tax cut proposals that we expect to be hearing from the president in this speech to the nation. We've also solicited some advice for President Clinton from a few people in and around politics who have their ideas about what he should say in this speech in order to revive his presidency. Also on today's program, we'll be hearing from children who live in group homes in the District of Columbia's foster care system, and we'll also mark the 50th anniversary of the day that Glenn Miller disappeared over the English Channel.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Yusuf Ibrahim is my guest. He's regional Middle East correspondent for The New York Times. Do you think that some of the Palestinians in the West Bank and the Gaza have become virtually ungovernable in the sense that they have rebelled against a government, an occupying force that they didn't want for so long, that, you know, is it possible to say they've forgotten what it's like to live under a government that they wanted to cooperate with?
I hesitate to say this because it's like canceling hope, and I think there is hope. I think there is another side to the Palestinian under Israeli occupation, which is, of course, that they do live on the fringes of a first world society, which is Israel, which is rich, which is prosperous, which has a democracy limited to Jews, of course. Which excludes the Palestinian, but which is manifestly right there for everybody to see, for the Palestinians to envy, if you like, to want to imitate. And the second thing, of course, is the Palestinians are and have been some of the most educated of and the most politically aware of all Arab population. I think the problem... there is hope for the Palestinian. I think they are governable, but they have got to have something tangible. They have got to see that the peace process really is bringing some benefits, political benefits and economic benefit.
For so many years, Yasser Arafat was the symbol of hope for the future for Palestinians, the symbol of a possibility of a Palestinian state, the symbol of Palestinian unity. And now he's the symbol of things gone wrong. He's the opposition for many Palestinians. Do you think that there's a lot of Palestinians who are, kind of heartbroken in a way, to see someone who'd been a symbol and a hero for so long now be discredited?
Of course, this is true. But heartbreak is almost the name of Palestinians. If you think, I know when you dabble with Palestinians, when you go into the camps, when you talk endlessly over a period of, say, 10 years to Palestinians in conversations that really, you know, only end to begin again, you just see the dimension of the tragedies through which they have lived. I mean, you go to a Palestinian home in the occupied territory, there isn't any home where kids haven't been arrested or thrown into jail or wounded and in many cases killed. Almost every other house has people who have died resisting. If you go outside in the diaspora, if you go to Palestinian camps in Lebanon and in Jordan. It's a heartbreak story. I mean, it's people who are refugees who are living in tents. Even if we talk to rich Palestinians who used to live in Kuwait, who had BMWs and Mercedeses, it hurts not to have an identity. It hurts not to have a passport. It hurts to be told you are nobody. And it hurts to be a refugee even in an Arab country, let alone outside an Arab country. So heartbreak is the name of Palestinians. Yes, I mean, they are disappointed. Are they the particularly disappointed as Arafat? No, I think most Palestinians were not innocent when it came to Arafat. They knew that Arafat was the symbol of the Palestinian revolution. And for many years, they've supported him as the symbol of the Palestinian revolution. They forgave him the maneuvering because he had to maneuver. He was leading a movement really with nothing. I mean, a shoestring movement from outside. He had to manipulate. He had to lie. He had to do this. He had to do that. But the disappointment, so nobody was naive about the character of Arafat and the kind of dictatorial tendencies of Arafat. But it was hoped, I think, by many Palestinians that once the autonomy process was launched, once it got support from the masses of Palestinians inside and those in the diaspora, that somehow Mr. Arafat will change. How much hope, I don't know, but really people were very hopeful. In that sense, yes, they are disappointed, but people will tell you, okay, what else did you expect?
Do you think Arafat might be pushed to resign by his own people? By people from the PLO, by people who...
I've known Arafat for 20 years. I have a very hard time seeing Yasser Arafat resigning from anything. No.
So even if he were pushed, he wouldn't do it. Is that what you're saying?
He would fight.
He would fight.
And they would fight.
Youssef Ibrahim is regional Middle East correspondent for the New York Times. He'll be back with us on Monday to talk about his experiences as an Arab American covering the Arab world for the Times. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person, with Alan Tu and Nancy Updike. Research assistance from Becky Cohen. Sienna Chrisman is our intern. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next archive edition of Fresh Air, to help you get in the spirit of holiday cooking, an interview with Julia Child. Also, we talk with rhythm and blues singer Etta James. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.